Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 56 of NML Crossing, where if you're listening in real time, you'll know I missed a day. I missed this past Monday. The weekend kind of got away from me. We had a bunch of moving stuff set up for the end of the week, and we were bumped up, and everything suddenly became a rushed panic, which was not pleasant. But not necessary, you know, it was necessary, and I'm glad that we were forced to do the stuff we did over the weekend. It was just one of those very unexpected things. I was expecting a much more loungy sort of weekend, and that was not in the cards. And then we had two nights of WrestleMania, so it was just, time was not on my side. I did happened to escape for a bit, and I ran to our travels actually had us in the neighborhood of one of my favorite shops, so I popped in there because I had, you ever have one of those like panicked moments? And I mean, I'm using panicked moments here because I am quite precious about things like this, but where you assume you own a whole bunch of comics and then you realize you don't, and it's like, oh crap. Yeah, and then suddenly you just need those comics more than anything in the world, right? It's like it's a sickness. That was the case with me. I've been, I mentioned over the past several weeks that I was catching up on the modern Batman, the Chip Zdarsky stuff. And there's a whole lot of Zurin R stuff in there, and that got me in the mood to check out, or in my mind, reread the Grant Morrison run, you know, just to see what connections were made and see how much was kept. And I go through my spreadsheet and I come to find that I don't own the entire Grant Morrison Batman run, which was like, yeah, you could have knocked me over with a feather. Turns out those books came out right around the time that my life was kind of falling apart back in the day. Lost the job, lost the house, all that kind of stuff happened all at once, and comics comics completely went on the distant back burner, so wasn't shopping, wasn't even really reading. I have a very weird collection from my unemployed days, because I was just buying whatever I could find in quarter bins. So I have, like, the weirdest indie stuff, the weirdest Image stuff, like, the stuff that nobody would possibly ever want. I was taking them because they were all I could afford. And, I mean, once a comics fan, you're always a comics fan. You always want to have something new to read or something new to chronicle or follow or collect. And the new releases, the full price releases, were way out of my price range at that point. So didn't have... I was missing 6 issues from the Morrison run. And so I managed to find all 6 in one stop. And it was a buy 2, get 1 free. So I was able to get all 6 of them for the price of 4. So it was pretty good. Pretty good. I was interested in checking out that, or rechecking the Grant Morrison run, because there was something about that run, even before it started, that I was kind of like mystified by. And this is a very Morrisonian thing. The rumor has it that he read every single Batman comic before, you know, starting his run. And I know he did that with the X-Men as well. When he took over with New X-Men, he read every X-Men story. And, I mean, if you read it, it's pretty clear. I mean, there's a lot of references to a lot of things. And so I really wanted to... I don't know if annotate is the right word, but I really wanted to go through the Morrison Batman run with a toothy comb, you know, and see what I could dredge up from the Golden and Silver Age and see what was being referenced to. I mean, Zurin R is the biggie, of course. Zurin R is a planet back in, oh boy, when was it? Mid-50s, maybe? And the Batman of Zurin R was a guy named Talano. And, of course, they modernized it for R.I.P. and whatnot. But I just wanted to track back, you know. I wanted to annotate just for my own benefit. Because that run is one that when I stop and think about it, and I realize that I haven't read the whole thing, I don't understand it. I don't understand it because if you were to ask me, how does Batman die in RIP, I would not have any answer for you. I would, because in my mind, he died twice. He died in RIP and he also died in Final Crisis. I don't know if he did or not, but that's my recollection of it. And I don't know if that's true or not. And that's one of the things I wanted to kind of hash out in my own mind. I also came into, the Batman encyclopedia that Michael Fleischer put together back in the mid-70s. I found a copy of that, and it's a lot of fun stuff in there, and I thought that might make the annotations a little bit easier for me, because I'll have this tome there. I mean, the research has been done for me, basically. But I don't know if that's something I will ever do as a quote-unquote project, or if it's just something so I can keep things straight, because I am fairly dense when it comes to things like symbolism, because I know Morrison is huge into symbolism. I either miss it completely or I attribute way too much importance to things that aren't. So, I don't know. All that to say, it was a busy weekend, and I apologize for missing the day. But we're here today, and today we're going to be wrapping up one of our story arcs here, our second story arc in No Man's Land proper. Well, third if we count the Azrael detour, but we won't. This is Detective Comics number 731, which had an April 1999 cover date. The story is Fear of Faith Part 4, Be Not Afraid. Written by Devin Grayson, pencils Dale Eaglesham, inks Sean Parsons, colors Noel Giddings, and Digital Chameleon. Letters Todd Klein, edits Illidge Vincenzo O'Neill, cover price $1.99. And it's hard to believe we're still doing Fear of Faith. It feels like we've been doing that one a while. But here we are. We're going to wrap it up now. And we pick up pretty much exactly where we left off last issue, where despite the protest from the Huntress, Father Chris's flock is preparing for war. The Scarecrow is narrating this scene, which is what he's been doing this entire arc. And he's talking more about hell, which he's been doing the entire arc. He even hits us with a reference to Jean-Paul Sartre. Is it Sartre? You know, the Hell is Other People guy? I say Sartre. I don't speak French. It might be wrong. But a reference to Sartre definitely feels like one of them turn-of-the-century young writer tropes. Now, Father Chris is outside confronting the former false facers, and he's pleading with them to allow this to end at least a little bit peacefully. And then a gunshot rings out. Chris instinctively feels his body for blood and finds none. Indeed, it was one of the false facers that just got shot. And this single shot inspires many, many more. And before we know it, the false facers are pretty much wiped out, and they are wiped out by the newly arrived Penguin Goons. Now Huntress rushes the refugees back into the church. Unfortunately, Rocky, or Carl, was it? Whatever the other Penguin Goon was called, he's already nabbed Father Chris, and he's threatening to plug him full of holes if the Ark Center doesn't hand over their hidden cache, the arsenal. Now Scarecrow, he is definitely playing the devil on the shoulder here. He is trying his damnedest to goad the parishioners into pulling plenty of triggers right now. Helena tries to reason with the refugees, but, I mean, they're scared, right? And they're in a situation where it might just boil down to kill or be killed. So they ain't exactly looking to be reasonable right now. Now, it's better for them to ask questions or forgiveness after the fact. Huntress does manage to get them to agree to give her 5 minutes to attempt to de-escalate the situation. And if she doesn't return or get results by then, well, the refugees have her full blessing to do whatever they feel they need to do in order to survive. Nearby, Batman is watching the hostage situation unfold through a pair of night vision goggles, and he also sees the arrival of the GCPD, and he's not all that pleased. Perhaps he realizes that their involvement can only lead to more bloodshed and death. Back outside the cathedral, the penguin goons keep shouting threats here, until one of them, and we're going to say it's Rocky, he winds up with a Huntress crossbow bolt right through his hand. And I wonder, you know, considering the story here, I wonder if this is a Stigmata reference. Probably not. Rocky releases Father Chris, but he isn't able to fully escape the grasp of the baddies. Batman, of course, he's still looking on, and he's watching the approach of the GCPD. He worries that this situation is about to go from really, really bad to really, really worse. Inside, Scarecrow continues pleading with the flock to take up their arms and to just start killing fools. Outside, Father Chris has been re-hostaged, with Rocky making it perfectly clear that he has zero qualms about blowing his brains out. Then, a shot rings out. Scarecrow starts cheering, then more shots, none of which manage to actually hit anyone. Probably wouldn't hit the broadside of a barn, actually. We finally see the shooter, and, well, it's a bleeding man wrapped in a towel. Father Papaleo, Pete fears that this is about to become a massacre. Well, I guess more of a massacre, I suppose. Considering all the false facers, save one, have been killed in cold blood, it's already a massacre. Indeed, it's that last remaining ex-black masker who's wildly shooting in the penguin goon's direction. Well, I guess in their general direction, considering he is a terrible, terrible shot. Scarecrow, he's still there. He's trying to goad Papaleo into giving the refugees the word to start protecting themselves. But Papaleo ain't about to go against the Huntress's request. We rejoin that final false facer, who is spouting off about having more ammunition than all the penguin goons combined, and then he just gives up. Seriously, he just stands up, steps out of his little cover, and he offers the penguin goons a trade. He's got 3 guns and a whole lot of ammo, and he's like, you can have all of this, but you have to let Father Chris go. Now, our guy then gets shot in the shoulder for his offer, so I guess the goons, they ain't fitting the least to listen here. Now, amid this distraction, Huntress is able to rescue Chris and pull him back inside the church. One thing I want to mention, but kind of feel bad doing so, is how choppy this entire issue has been up to this point. Like, it feels like more of a collection of scenes awkwardly cutting to one another than a smoothly flowing story. Like, this bit here, with, you know, Huntress dragging Chris back into the church. How did this bit happen? It almost feels like we missed a page, or at least a handful of panels. And I mean, I'm doing my best here to make the synopsis flow smoothly, but I just wanted to note that it is taking a little bit of doing. Anyway, inside, the Scarecrow is having a conniption. He's demanding the refugees give in to their fear and to strike back at the goons with the vengeance of the righteous. Just then, someone enters, and it's Leo. Not Papa Leo, he's already there. This is Leo, the false facer, the leader of Mikey's little splinter group, and also the dude who shot Mikey a couple of issues ago. Now, he's the guy who offered the goons the weapons for Father Chris, that trade earlier. And he tells Huntress that he told him he could find sanctuary at the Ark. And who exactly is he? Well, it's Batman, of course, and we join him outside as he proceeds to beat the bejesus out of the penguin goons. Now, as he's powing and biffing, Commissioner Gordon orders his blue boys to move in. Gordon sees Batman. He sees him as Batman's warning the goons that the penguin is not welcome on this block. Oh, and Batman's also tossing, like, tear gas grenades to mask his exit. Gordon, as you might imagine, he is not pleased. He calls back the troops. He's not happy to do so, and he does not trust the sanctuary's current savior, but he says he does trust the integrity of Father Chris, so he's gonna, you know, let them do their thing. Back inside, Leo is given the floor to explain his side of the story, and he lays the blame for the entire thing at the feet of the Scarecrow. You see, of course, we know he told the false facers to take the weapons, and that the flock would simply lay down and let them. And he wonders if maybe the Scarecrow probably tipped off the penguin as well. Well, Crane deflects, reminding the Ark that Leo here killed their good friend Mikey. Which, it turns out, is more than enough for the refugees to start getting violent. Before they're able to rip Leo limb from limb, Huntress cries out for them to settle their tea kettles. Helena tells the refugees that, should they go through with their righteous vengeance, the Scarecrow will win. And that's all he wants. She tells them all that it's okay to feel fear. And in fact, well, there's a lot to be scared of right now. Mikey, themselves, Father Chris. And guess what? Right now, everybody's cool. Everybody's safe. Even Mikey is off recovering somewhere. So all the things that they're afraid of, well, they really ought not be. She then turns to the Scarecrow to thank him. Thank him for reminding them all that even in these dark, uncertain, and hopeless times, they still have so much left to lose. And so the parishioners all turn to the Scarecrow and forgive him. And they thank him. And they pray for him and pray at him. And it's enough to freak old Crane out to the point where he just runs away. Meanwhile, Papa Leo joins Huntress in an adjoining room, or hallway perhaps. He thanks her for everything she's done for the Ark, and she says that she kind of just fell into her teaching mode, which is something she hasn't had the opportunity to do for a while now. From here, we pop in on the goons reporting back to the Penguin. They reveal that Father Chris and the gang are planning on dumping the arsenal into the drink. And indeed, we see that's exactly what's happening. Of course, Father Chris knows how valuable weapons and ammo are in No Man's Land, but he also knows that whoever they might trade these resources to will use them in order to kill. Rocky asks the Penguin if they ought to take the Ark down, to which Ozzy declines. He says that Gotham City will eat Father Chris soon enough. Elsewhere, we join the Scarecrow as he pulls that whole, like, Spider-Man burning his costume in a garbage can gimmick. He cries out, realizing that No Man's Land has no room for the Scarecrow. From here, we hop to the end, where Batman is bringing the new Batgirl to his current base of operations. And he's got her blindfolded. She asks if she can remove it, and he doesn't respond. To which she says, "I will take silence as consent." That kind of makes that scene in Nightwing make a little bit more sense, doesn't it? Anyway, we close out with the revelation that Batman is currently operating out of Alan Grant's old place, Arkham Asylum. And that's where we leave it. Next time out, we're going to kick off our two-part Bread and Circuses in, I think it's Legends of the Dark Knight, maybe number 117. I guess we'll find out next time. But first, let's talk about the end of Fear of Faith, which was good. It all wrapped up pretty neatly, which, you know, the round robin approach to storytelling, it kind of has to, right? They can't leave too many dangling threads here, or too many questions unanswered, or too many things nebulous before handing it off. As we get into these follow-up arcs here, I don't want to jump ahead, but you get the feeling, or at least I do, that the writers were given their assignments, but they weren't told like what order they were going to go in, because there's going to be some choppiness. It's not going to be completely smooth. That's all I'll say for now. We'll get into that more probably in the next couple of episodes, but this wrapped up clean enough. The situation at the Ark is all taken care of. We can kind of rest assured. I don't even know if we're going to hear from them again. I mean, they might just be from this point on. Who knows? The only issue I really have with this issue is the action was very choppy. You know, like I mentioned during the synopsis, it did feel as though these were just like odd bits of action that were just happening in the same place. And while I am extremely dense, I can still follow a short story. And this kind of felt all over the place during the climax, I guess. But overall, I did enjoy my time with this story. I thought it was really good early story for this. I think we talked about this in the first part, where in the uncertain times, times where there is no hope, people will turn to faith. Even the cynics among us, you know, the whole, you know, no atheists in a foxhole sort of gimmick. I think we all want to feel protected. We all want to feel safe and secure, even or especially in those times where security seems to be the furthest thing from reality. So I think this made a lot of sense, and it was a wise play for one of the early No Man's Land arcs. And speaking of being cynical, I really liked the Penguins a little bit at the end here, where they're like, hey, should we take these guys down? And Penguin knows that No Man's Land is not built for good people. And he's pretty certain that nothing good will come to anyone trying to take the moral high ground in the post-Quake world here. I like how that's where his mind goes. He literally says, you know, this city will eat him up, so we don't even need to worry about him. And will that happen? Don't know. But we've seen up to this point where the power lies, and it's not usually with the righteous. It's usually with those who are willing to be as evil as possible. And we will be checking in on the Penguin in the next arc. He will be the big bad for that arc. So I look forward to checking that out and sharing that with you all. But I think that's probably all I got to say about Fear of Faith. We kind of talked this one into the ground over the course of the past several episodes. But of course, if anybody out there would like to talk about it, I would love to hear your thoughts, which is as good a segue as any into our NML bag. And we got a couple of letters here to discuss. We're going to start with CJ. And he says, because I mentioned either last episode or the one before that, that I love the way omnibuses look on a shelf. I love how heavy they feel. You feel powerful holding an omnibus, you know? It's like you have all of this lore, all of this story in your hands, just pounds of it. And it's an amazing feeling. But they're hard to read. Damn near impossible to read. So CJ says, reading omnibuses is definitely a chore. I only have a few, like the Milestone Compendium. Maybe not technically an omnibus because it's not a hardcover, but the page count is the same as omnibuses, which I have because there are no trades or graphic novels for Milestone other than that. I do get individual issues when I get a chance, but that leaves large holes in my collection. Now, I didn't even know there was a Milestone Compendium. That sounds very interesting because my Milestone knowledge is sparse. that might even be generous to say my knowledge of Milestone is sparse. That was on the Chris and Reggie list doing some Milestone stuff because neither of us really had much experience with the Milestone. The Dakotaverse, was it? But they always looked very interesting. They always looked cool. They always looked sorta mainstream, but also sorta not. I don't know how to explain it. Because, you know, clearly they were DC books, but they had like almost a Malibu or maybe Valiant feel to them. I don't know if that makes any sense. It probably doesn't, but that's just... When I was, you know, an 11 or 12 year old idiot going to a comic shop, they felt more like they had more in common with like the Malibu books or the Valiant stuff. I really don't know. But I wonder if there is like a hard and fast rule that an omnibus has to have a hardcover. Maybe that could be our next talking point, right? When I think of those like omnibus sized soft covers, I always go back to the you know, the Dave Sim terminology, the phone book, you know, which as luck or as coincidence would have it, I recently started filling in some of my Cerebus holes, you know, the, that sounded gross, Cerebus holes, the phone books. I found a shop that had almost all of them for $5 each. And I think I needed like five or six of them to have the set. And I found like four of them there. So I'm down to needing two or three, I think, because I've always wanted to give Cerebus a read. I've had the first volume for probably 25 years now, and it's big, so it's hard to read. I have a, what is it? The Bone Omnibus. You know, I think it's called the Bone Omnibus. Nope, I was wrong. I had to get up and check. It's the Bone One Volume Collection. It's the entire story of Bone in one volume, which is another one of those like bucket list books for me. It's just so hard to read because it's so damn heavy. Yeah, my bucket list reads are all kind of like that. Cerebus, Love and Rockets, and Bone. It's big books. Back to CJ. He says, I always liked the Legends of the Dark Knight's original focus and stories. As it moved away from that, I still enjoyed its stories overall, but I feel like its general reason for being, and being unique, was largely lost when it did that. It occurred to me that Marvel is doing a lot of minis like this. Silver Surfer with Ron Mars and Ron Lim. Peter David on Symbiote Spider-Man and Joe Fixit Hulk minis. But DC doesn't seem to do it as much from my perspective. And you know, I think I'm kind of glad they don't. Because, those minis are tough reads, in my opinion. You know, I'm a huge Peter David fan, so when we had Joe Fixit and, a Maestro, or a couple of Maestro series, there was the new Fantastic Four series, those were hard. Even the Janice Vell Captain Marvel, which was a favorite of mine around the turn of the century, that miniseries was, the first issue was good, and then it just kind of fell off for me. They just feel like they don't matter. And maybe if Marvel wasn't, like, absolutely flooding the racks with them, I'd feel differently. But, like, every month there's, like, four or five of them. And it's just, that's just too damn many. DC, another reason why I'm glad DC doesn't do them is because if they're, like, 90s variant covers are any indication, I don't think they would take it seriously. I mean, I think I've complained about these variants before, where it's like Superman with a hairdryer because, oh, he had long hair, so lol. I hate that crap. I almost cursed right there. I hate that. I hate when we can say, when we can distill something down to a decade. I feel like that's kind of lazy. Maybe I'm being too precious. Maybe I'm projecting. I don't know. But I am kind of glad DC doesn't do those kind of things. CJ continues. I wonder why that is. Why did DC do this for such a big book in Legends of the Dark Knight decades ago, but largely isn't doing something like it now, even in minis? Why did Marvel decide to start doing this relatively recently with their minis? I won't say these Marvel minis are perfect, but neither was Legends of the Dark Knight. But I do like these approaches as a way to have a different flavor or era of a character consistently on the rack. And you know, just in reading that paragraph, I might have come up with another reason why DC doesn't do that. Because nobody at DC knows continuity. They don't know what happened and what didn't. So I think they'd have trouble doing something like that because who the hell would fact check it? Just idiots like me who would get mocked for it if I said anything out loud about it. But I do agree that the original mission statement for Legends of the Dark Knight was really cool. And I actually, that's another book I'm trying to track down now, because if I do this Morrison annotation little gimmick, he had a run early in Legends of the Dark Knight called Gothic. I do have a trade collection of it. At least I think I do. I could have sworn I did. Maybe I don't. Maybe it doesn't even exist. I would have to turn my head away. It does not turn naturally in order to find out right now. But the original mission statement, where they're just filling in all the stuff, introducing new gimmicks like Venom, and just having fun with the history of the character, just filling in some blanks, not really making, you know, huge waves, but adding flavor. I really like that. When it changed into like a mainstream, mainline Bat book, I mean, I'm not mad at it. I appreciate extra chapters where we can fit them. Where I kind of fell off was the Elseworlds kind of stuff. I was never, I'm still not a fan of that kind of stuff. I know why they do it. I mean, and I'm sure most people dig it. I'm just not one of those people, unfortunately. CJ continues, and this is about something I said either last episode or the one before that about trying to fill in my Batman collection from 400 to 500. And as I'm doing so, I'm realizing just how much stuff happened in that 100 issues, those 10 years or 8 to 10 years. And I kind of lamented the fact that we don't really get that anymore. You know, we hardly get 10 issues of books now, much less 10 years where stuff happens, stuff that's, you know, seminal and memorable and citable and something we can reflect back on. We don't get that too often, certainly not as often as we used to. And CJ says, the last 10 years of memorable stories topic. I think there are some more than you were mentioning, but I do think there aren't as many as there were in other decades pre-2000. Company-wide crossovers, multiple times a year, maybe even quarterly, definitely has caused too much disruption to have most stories gain and maintain steam. I also feel like the crossovers have gotten bigger. The 90s had plenty of crossovers, but they largely remained in a family of books. When it's done that way, it seems easier to keep building the pre-crossover story. And that's 100% true. That's definitely true. Because crossovers aren't a new thing, of course. It's just that they were done differently. You know, take this very project we're working on right now with No Man's Land. I mentioned this before. When I started this up, or when I was considering starting this up, I didn't know where to start. You know, because the Bat books are largely in crossover for the entirety of the 1990s and into the, you know, 2000s as well, where it's like, where do you start? Well, we know that it's No Man's Land because of an earthquake, but it's also because of a virus and the second virus. But the virus was started by the geeks over at Saint Dumas. So do we have to go back to Sword of Azrael? And if we do, well, do we have to go through Nightfall and Night Quest and Night's End? And if we do that, do we got to do Vengeance of Bane? And if we do that, yada, 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 are we going all the way back to year one? I mean, where does it start? So definitely crossovers are a thing. But as CJ points out here, when kept into a family of books, they can build upon themselves, right? You can keep the crossovers going. You can keep the story going. And everything builds on itself. Whereas post-2000, everything became multiversal, intergalactic, and everything you thought you knew was wrong, where every book has to be involved and get a miniseries. You know, you can have the X-Men crossover issues and a miniseries. It is just so much crap and so much stop-start where nothing can really build up. You can't get, like CJ says here, you can't gain or maintain steam. And that's a big problem. CJ continues, decompression also hurts in this manner. I think partly because it means there's a lot less story arcs being created, so there's less chances there'll be more memorable ones. But I also think decompression, ironically, leads to focusing too much on just what's important in that one story arc, which leaves supporting casts and subplots developing less, which in turn create shallower stories. Boom. 100%. I agree 100%. Decompression, which, of course, we know is a construct that doesn't actually exist. It's just a shared delusion that we comic fans have. It does not exist. But it, like CJ points out here, it hurts in both regards. You know, everything has a start and an end. And, I mean, I'm a lifelong X-Men fan, where that's a book that was known for subplots being dangled and dribbled and just bubbling away in the background. Where everything felt like, I mean, you could have a crossover in the X-Books, but you'll also have subplots bubbling throughout them that'll connect, you know, it'll just connect the entire serial. And we really don't get that now. And there are a lot of reasons for that, probably, not just things like decompression. I think writers have shorter tenures on books now, you know? Writers, I might be projecting, but I feel like writers are using comics as a stepping stone to, you know, bigger and better things. Where back in our day, comics writers wanted to write comics. Now it's they're hoping that someone, some exec at Netflix sees their work and options something of theirs or hires them to do whatever. Again, I might be projecting, but I think that hurts the memorable or seminal stories a lot as well. CJ continues. In the last 10 years, I've liked Peter Tomasi's Superman run. Yes, it was inconsistent, but I thought Clark and Lois on the farm raising young John is a great concept that was taken away way too early by aging John up. True. Very true. CJ continues, although I did not like the aging up, I do like Taylor's Superboy Superman John Kent stuff. Now, there's a run I never gave a fair shake to. I hated that they aged John. I loved the dynamic of Clark with a young son. I thought that was really, really cool. You know, people talk about, like, how old is Superman? And my answer to that is always, Superman is as old as your dad was when you discovered Superman. So I love the dynamic between a Superman and son. Aging him up, the stupid Bendis stuff, ugh. Definitely taken away from us too soon. They kind of flushed all the goodwill of Rebirth down the toilet in order to hand stuff over to Bendis, who isn't even there anymore. That's how much he cared. He's already gone. But his stink, it's going to take a while for that to clear out, unfortunately. Back to CJ. The X-Men Krakoa stuff, again inconsistent, is still a great story that seems like it'll be referred to a lot over the years. Jason Aaron's Thor stories are partly in the last 10 years, and I'd say those were great stories that'll be referred to a lot. Most things Al Ewing has done are great, and will at least be referred to by him for years after. I like Eve Ewing, too. I'm sure I'm forgetting some, but I do think part of the reason it seems like there are less memorable stories is because industry changes mentioned above. But part of it is also, for me at least, is that we read a lot less Marvel and DC now than we used to, especially newer comics. And that's true. That's true. And I hope I said that last time, that I am reading far less. So I am speaking at least partly in ignorance. and that's why I count on all of you to fact check me and tell me where I'm wrong and to point out things that maybe I ought to check out. The Krakoa stuff, I feel like, will be referred to. As for the rest, I'll have to take your word for it. I have not read any Immortal Hulk. I've heard good things. You know, actually, that's not true. I did read the first issue on Marvel Unlimited, and I thought it was a good story. I just didn't think it was a good Hulk story. I think I read the first two or three while waiting for a doctor's appointment and never went back. Al Ewing, as much as I didn't want to like him, I like his work. I just didn't like it as Hulk. But thank you so much for sharing your thoughts, CJ. And of course, I'd love to hear what am I missing? What am I leaving out from the recent current stuff? Please hit me up and let me know. Let me know what I'm missing out on. Not sure that I'll be able to get to everything, but I don't know. Maybe it'll just make me feel better knowing that there are still seminal stories being told, still building, on the foundation of what came before, and hopefully, laying more foundation that'll be built upon later. Next up, our friend Chris Yu talking some Fear of Daith, and he says, this arc started out kind of slow, but it's reached a nice crescendo here. Scarecrow proves himself a master of fear manipulation. He feels far more cerebral than he normally does. Most Scarecrow stories rely too heavily on the fear gas as a tool. I like the cerebral Scarecrow far more. Definitely agree. Scarecrow, for me, it's funny. I think about Rogues Galleries and comics overall, and for being such a huge comic fan, and, comics have been my life for a very long time, and when certain members of various Rogues Galleries pop into comics or pop into series, sometimes I roll my eyes. Ra's al Ghul is my primary example. When it's a Batman Ra's story, it's just like, no. Okay, I'm going to skip a few months. And Scarecrow kind of teeters on the brink for me. When I saw that this Fear of Faith story was going to be a Scarecrow one, I wasn't excited. I really wasn't excited until until the story won me over. I love the way Grayson has this powerless scarecrow, this fear toxinless scarecrow, showing just how dangerous he is. And when you take the cerebral scarecrow with the added element of fear toxin, you realize just how scary this character can be. He doesn't need the gas, but the gas helps. You know, it's really, really cool. And I love the fact that he was able to nearly whip up a bloody, bloody war just with his words. You know, it's pretty cool stuff. And I mean, these are tense times in No Man's Land, of course, but he's able to toy with these people. And I mean, he came real close to pulling it off. So really, really cool. Back to Chris. He says, the interaction between Bruce and Leslie was my favorite part of the issue. She's another supporting character that makes sense to have stayed in Gotham City. Her history of providing medical care in war zones will come in handy in this No Man's Land. And you know, I think I neglected to even really talk much about that scene, but that was a really, really good one. The speech that Leslie gave when Bruce asked why she stayed was like almost tailor-made. You know, she was inspired by Bruce's father. Really cool stuff. You know, he said that he won't leave as long as there's work to be done. And we can see that, you know, the apple didn't fall far from the tree. We don't know where Bruce went for a few months, but he's here now. And part of the reason why he's there is for Leslie. It's like a, you know, snake eating its own tail here. They need each other, and they want to be there for each other, and they want to, you know, be the best versions of themselves for each other. It's really cool stuff. Chris continues. Everybody equates Alfred as Bruce's father figure after the deaths of his parents, but Leslie can give Bruce a real link to his actual father. She may be the closest thing Bruce has to a mother figure for most of his life. Yeah, I can't think of anyone else. Who would Bruce turn to, you know, as a mother figure? It would have to be Leslie, which is kind of, I think that's kind of the reason why so many people had bad taste in their mouth after War Games a few years after this, which that was one of the times where I walked away from Batman was during War Games. I didn't even get to the part where Leslie does the thing, but that was rough, and I could definitely see long-term, you know, seasoned Bat fans really being turned off by that. Chris continues. My favorite line in the entire issue is when the false facer talks about Batman and the two broads he's working with. Lots of good breadcrumbs here for Batman's two partners. Oh, I wonder what you're getting at there. Maybe we'll find out soon. But yeah, that was very cool. And I tried to emphasize that in the synopsis. The two broads he's working with. Very, very interesting. But thank you so much for writing in and sharing your thoughts, Chris. I always enjoy hearing from you. I always enjoy hearing from all of you, which I guess is a good segue into me begging you to write in. Or maybe begging's too strong a word. Inviting you to write in. If anybody would like to talk about pretty much anything, feel free. You can find me all those different ways. Chris is on infiniteearths.com, chrisandreggie.podbean.com, weirdcomicshistory@gmail.com, and all the social media places. But I think that's going to do it for me for today. I'd like to thank you all so much for sharing some of your day with me. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. Got an astounding twist.